1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone, where today, Amy Wright catches up with Jody Whelan. Jody's the oldest son of the late and legendary singer-songwriter, John Prine. Jody also runs the label that Prine co-founded, Oh Boy Records, the ins and outs of which he discusses in detail with Amy this hour. In fact, a lot of today's talk revolves around John, how he grew up, his career, what led him to start Oh Boy, the growth of artist-owned and indie labels, as well as the various artists that have been signed to Oh Boy, including Kelsey Walden, Trey Burt, and Arlo McKinley. It's a fascinating conversation, and we're glad you can be a part of it. So let's turn it over to Amy and Jody and hear what they have to say. From Diddy TV, this is Insights.
So Jody, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, where are you right now? Are you in Nashville or?
Yeah, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm at home, a little under the weather. Thankfully not COVID, but just trying to not get everyone else sick, you know, so we can do all the things we've been planning to do for the last 2 years without another interruption.
Yeah, so Oh Boy Records was started by John Prine. And for those who don't know, you're John Prine's son, one of his children. And you're now running Oh Boy. And so I thought, or when did you actually join John Prine at the label?
In 2015. So John started Oh Boy in 1981 with his manager, Al Bonetta, and Dan Einstein, who was kind of came like a label executive who came on and helped launch the label. Al was helping kind of run the label, and tragically kind of passed away suddenly in 2015. And that's when I kind of got roped into / volunteered to take over, because, you know, Al had been there so long that we didn't know what we wanted to do, but John didn't want to go to another record label, you know, and he liked having his family around him. So we thought, well, okay, you know, we'll be modest and humble and in our goals. And, you know, you've already done a lot of the hard work. You've wrote the songs, you've got the fan base. We don't have to like swing for the fences. We can just, you know, try and keep it on the pace. And then that did. And, you know, and he still has the best fans, you know, and they really want to support him, but also they've known the label and support the other artists. So, it's been great, but, yeah, so I guess it's been 7 years now.
Well, I'm a huge fan. I love John's music and saw him as many times as I could play live. What was it like growing up with John?
I mean, he was, you know, Mr. America. Like, he really was. He loved, you know, he loved Christmas. So I grew up in Ireland. John married my mom, and John adopted me later on in life. And so I moved to America when I was 12. And the way as a kid in Europe, thinking about America as a place where all the cool things are and the movies and everything, the sports, and the food, that was him. Like, he kept that sort of wonder of like someone that doesn't even live in America, you know, like, and so he had that. And, you know, but it was, I mean, he was obviously like, you know, if you know his music, like he wasn't unaware that not everyone got to participate in it in the same way he did, right? Like, he still like, you know, he was the voice of like people who were forgotten or left behind. But I think like that's almost why, you know, sad songs are so sad, because it's like, you know, he had the idea of the country and what it could be. And that's what, you know, if it wasn't living up to them, like that's where a lot of the sort of, like, Hello in There is like, I think, one of the saddest songs ever. And it's about, you know, a couple that kind of does everything and has the American dream and but they're forgotten about, you know, and like to him, that was the most heartbreaking thing, or a veteran that comes back and isn't properly taken care of, you know, that was his, you know, so I think like being around him and, you know, moving to America and then he's your dad. It's sort of like, it's, you really get all, you know, you get to, got the full, like, yeah, just like Mr. America, you know? So he was a lot of fun. There was a lot of great music. And he was just, yeah, he was a really kind, he was a good dad. And, you know, heartbreakingly, he was a great, great grandpa. And, you know, my kids still want to listen to his music in the morning on the way to school. And, you know, thankfully we've got lots of pictures and videos, but you know, that part's still sad some days, 'cause he was as good as he was kind of as a dad, I think as a grandfather, he really, like, you know, he was like born to play that role.
I bet he was. He's such a storyteller too. And the way he tells stories, it's really beautiful how he rolls a story out. And in a very short period of time, you've seen someone's life pass in front of you and you have an essence of what happened to them. Not many people can do that in a song. And of course, he's well known to be one of the best songwriters on the planet. But I thought I would go back and just ask you a few questions about how he grew up, because Oh Boy, he started Oh Boy, and I kind of wanted to get to what led him to start the label in the first place. But where did he grow up?
So he grew up in Chicago, in a western suburb called Maywood, which is like, it was working class, kind of a mixed desegregated neighborhood. His dad was worked in a canning factory, but was also like really heavily involved in like labor unions. So like John kind of had that, you know, like the importance of work and the dignity of work and sort of like, you know, blue collar ethic really put into him. His mom, Verna Valentine Prine, was mainly stay-at-home mom who would, you know, always cook. And John had three other brothers. So, you know, I think just taking care of them and the house was a full-time job. you know, the family was originally from Kentucky, you know, famously Muhlenberg County. And I think growing up, they always felt like they were Kentucky. John said, like, they were Kentuckians that lived in Chicago, you know. I mean, and John loves Chicago and still can, you know, like, but I think like his parents especially like would always kind of drill that into him, like, you know, someday we're going to go back, you know. And they would visit Kentucky a lot. So I think he, you know, I mean, he loves Chicago, and that's where, you know, he started writing and performing. But I think he always kind of had part of Kentucky in him too, in his upbringing. And I think, you know, there was music in the house. His dad was a big fan of country music. His older brother, Dave, was a big fan of country music and old-timey kind of music. And that's where I think John started to kind of learn how to play guitar and sing, came from there. So, yeah.
I was wondering, how young was he when he started playing?
So the way he tells the story is that basically he was like the little brother that got roped into it, you know, by like his brother, Dave. Like, Dave kind of wanted to have a band, you know, and so like he would try and get John to learn how to play stuff. So I think pretty young. I don't think he likes, it was probably more like in his teens when he probably started kind of getting good at it, being able to write songs. I mean, he wrote some of the songs on his first two albums he wrote as a teenager, which is, you know, like Far From Me on the first album and Sour Grapes that was on the second album. I think it was that, you know, I think he, as a songwriter, like it was early, he was interested in it, but I think a lot of it too, he said it was like to try and impress his dad, who was really into country music. And so like, he would memorize like Hank Williams songs and play them back for his dad. And then when he went to the army, he would kind of, you know, play, some country music and stuff that other guys in the barracks would like, and that was his way to connect. And it kind of was after he came back from the army that he started like writing more songs, and some of the like the big ones, like, you know, Angel from Montgomery, Sam Stone, and Hello in There. And that was kind of in his like early 20s.
So he served in Vietnam, right? Was that
so? Drafted during Vietnam, and he but he didn't get sent to Vietnam. Basically, all of his friends did. You know, he's like, he had a really kind of modest and self-effacing way. So he said what happened was like, you know, they'd give you a test to like figure out what your aptitude is and where you're going to get sent. And he just kind of like didn't look at it and just marked everything. And they labeled him as like a mechanical genius. And he got sent to Germany to work on like the really big equipment and like construction equipment. So he served in Germany during Vietnam. I mean, he loved a good story. So sometimes I'm always like, is that true? Or like, cause like he also was really into cars too. So like, I think, you know, but I think he definitely found himself, he thought of himself as, you know, obviously really lucky because a lot of the boys he went to school with, didn't come back, you know, or if they did come back, they were, injured, you know, either physically or had suffered PTSD.
Yeah. I was wondering if he ever talked about that as something that kind of influenced him in some way, because anyone who's served, you know, has that, and it's really hard to remove oneself completely from the experiences. I mean, it sounds like he didn't have to actually go to Vietnam, but even just having friends that went.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it was hard for him to wrestle with. Like, his basic training was in, you know, it was in Louisiana. So like everyone was getting trained to go to Vietnam. It was like, you know, jungle training and like in the swamp and getting ready. And so I think he had kind of prepared himself for it. And, you know, I don't know if he ever like had kind of guilt like that he got sent to Germany and like a lot of his buddies got sent. You know, I mean, sadly, even some of the people he served with in Germany, like, you know, from the kind of the boredom and the time downtime, like addiction was still an issue there. And so some of the things he talked about in Sam Stone wasn't just happening to folks that had served in Vietnam. It was also just, you know, people, again, I don't think there was the kind of the language to talk about any of this stuff back then, but like, and folks would, you know, whether it was language around addiction or trauma, but, you know, he saw like some folks went over there and just didn't handle being home and then got hooked on something. And, you know, so I think part of it in his head was what was going on in Vietnam, but he also, I think, saw that experience and while he was in Germany too.
So when he came back, was he playing music? What was he doing? Did he get a job or?
He did. He got a job as he delivered mail in Maywood. He had a postal route, and that's where he wrote his songs in his head. I think he was like an amazing guitar player, especially, you know, later in life as he really developed his style. But I don't think he ever considered himself like a musician's musician. So, you know, where some people can kind of write down like chords and stuff, he would just kind of hum things in his head and say out lines and then maybe write it down on a scratch of paper and then come back to it. And it was just delivering mail is where he kind of started working on those songs that were going to be on his first album.
I'm sure he was a great mail person, but yeah. I'm glad he ended up as a great musician.
You know, he said he was like terrible. He was always like find the slowest way. You know, he would like be the last one to finish his route because he'd be daydreaming or like, you know, there was like no benefit to like completing your route quicker because then they would just give you more work. So he would do it all, you know, in the maximum amount of time possible.
So was he playing open mic nights or what was he doing with his music?
I think a little bit, you know, so again, with the, you know, from the influence for his brother, like, you know, there was still music going on. It's still around. It's called the Old Town School of Folk. His brother took classes there and then later taught, I believe. And just as an interest in sort of folk music and playing guitar, he would go there. And then after sessions there was like, you know, a bar close by where some people will go and there'll be open mics, but he wasn't really doing a lot of open mic stuff before things took off really quickly for him. You know, the way he tells it is he did open mic night and played some of like Sam Stone, I think Hello in There, and maybe like Paradise, I think. And, you know, he had those songs and they're like, can you come back and do that again? And it was, you know, it happened really quickly for him. You know, it was in like 1970. And then, you know, his record deal with Atlantic was in 71. So you know, I think there was a really supportive scene, you know, like Steve Goodman and some other folks in there really kind of lifted everyone up. And pretty quickly he got a regular club job and then quit the mail service and then got discovered by, you know, Kristofferson and sent to New York, and it happened. It was kind of a whirlwind, you know.
How was he discovered by Kris Kristofferson?
Through his buddy Steve Goodman. Who's a great singer-songwriter. I think Steve was playing or opening for Chris, and it had gone well. And, you know, Steve and John were best friends. And I think, John always really credited Steve. It's like, Steve didn't have to do that. Like, he could have used that connection to further his own career. But instead, he, like, reached back and told Chris, like, if you think I'm good, you've got to go hear John. You know, and the story was that he brought Paul Anka and Kris Kristofferson to this little club that John had done, and he'd already done playing, and he was sort of drinking his beer and counting, like, you know, the money he made. And they made him get back on stage, and he did a few songs, and then they asked him to do them again, and he did. And then pretty quickly after that, you know, they go up to New York, and Chris brings them into Atlantic Records. And, you know, he signs a contract like the next day.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was pretty unusual for folks from Chicago to get signed. Like, everyone, you know, had to go to New York or LA. You mean, there was a scene in Nashville too at that time, but, you know, it wasn't like it. What, you know, now with the internet, you can kind of discover someone anywhere, right? And go where they are, and each place has their music scenes. But back then, especially, like, you sort of had to do it in front of the record executives and, like, on the coast. And so, you know, everyone was really excited back in Chicago when John and Steve also got a deal, you know, without having to kind of leave Chicago, you know, to do it.
And of course, he was compared very quickly to Bob Dylan, who was another great songwriter that had come just before him. Did they know each other at all throughout their life? Or?
Yeah, they got to connect a little bit. I mean, John always thought, like, you know, that he wouldn't have had a job if it wasn't for Bob Dylan. You know, like, he not only opened the door, like, he, like, created the door that someone like him could walk through. That was sort of, it was folk music, but it was also, like, a real, like, country influence, but also brought in, like, a bit of rock and roll. So yeah, I mean, he was definitely one of John's songwriting heroes. And then, you know, I guess he always sort of resented that, like, people were kind of trying to compare him, because he, you know, he had such high respect for Bob, but he knew that sort of what he did was a little bit different. But I think, like, then he later learned that it was, like, the people at his record label, like, doing that to try and, you know, like, that's what you're going to do. It's like, oh, if you like Bob Dylan, you know, like, sounds like, and that's just, you know, to try and help sell records. But he, you know, I guess Bob had gotten an early advance copy of John's first record and liked it and got to, like, he showed up at one of John's club shows in New York and sang on one of the songs, and he said some nice things that, you know, our publicists like to quote about John, you know, through the years. So yeah, I don't know how many people, like, Bob invites over for a barbecue. You know, he's not that kind of guy, but I think, like, when people have asked him about songwriters he admires, like, you know, it meant something to John that, like, his name came up, because, like, he holds him in such high regard.
You know, it seems like that era of the 60s, late 60s and through the 70s was such a golden era for the songwriter. So much great music with lyrically came out at that time. Yeah. And I don't know whether it's competition or, you know, everyone's elevating everybody else to another level, but it just seems like so much great music came out.
No, you're right. I was actually looking at just that year, 1971, when John's first record came out. Like, it is just, they actually just made a documentary, I think, on Apple about it, like, just about that year in music, because it just seemed, it was just this explosion, you know. I think part of it was that the major labels used to not want to have their artists write their own songs. You know, like, being a performing songwriter wasn't really a thing. It was like, well, let's find, you know, we'll use our best songwriters and get our best voice and get our best producer and we'll make this product. And I think this sort of identity of, like, the singer-songwriter, I mean, it had been around before, I think, like, in folk music, you know, like, with, like, Pete Seeger and some other folks, and maybe, like, Hank Williams a little bit. But the idea of, like, the performing singer-songwriter was sort of a new thing. And I really do think, like, you know, Dylan and Joni Mitchell and some of those other early folks really kind of created that genre. And yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, the early 70s. I mean, it was such an explosion, you know. I don't know if there was like just this pent up, all these great songs that needed to get out, you know.
It is interesting in history how there are certain eras that you can point to that everything kind of came together
yeah.
in this beautiful way.
I mean,
way.
Also, I think like the popularity of the album format, you know, like, because for so much, like the, it used to be the record business was just about singles. And so like making 45s, getting on the radio, selling the singles. But then you get to the album format and where you can tell kind of like bigger stories, longer stories, or people can really connect to an artist. I think that certainly served John really well. And I think it probably served a lot of kind of that wider constellation. Like, I mean, think about someone like Townsend Van Zandt, right? Like, yeah, he's got like songs that a lot of people know, but really like it's like listen to an like a Guy Clark album or Townsend Van Zandt album, you know, that's where you really like make a connection and like sort of get into the world and sort of really get to understand that artist, you know? So yeah, I mean, it is funny like how trends, you don't always think about like technology or trends like and how that affects art. But yeah, I mean, if John had like started his career when everyone was just doing like, you know, two songs, like, yeah, I don't know if he would have had the same career or if he'd started, you know, last year when like, you know, playlists and social media were kind of how most people are discovering music. Like, yeah, I'm not sure.
So he was on Atlantic when he started, and then he put out three albums with Atlantic, right? And then went to Asylum?
Four albums, and then they put out kind of a Greatest Hits, which was pretty early. But I think they didn't really know what to kind of do with them. And then, yeah, Elektra, kind of Asylum, he put out another three records. That was also owned by, I guess at the time, Atlantic. So they kind of, I think they didn't really know what to do with him. And they thought maybe, well, this will give him another shot if he goes over there. So, you know, he's kind of stayed in the same, label family.
What did he think of being a part of a label? Was it something he thought was helpful or not?
So I think initially, right, I mean, that's just the only thing you do. I don't think, you know, there was many other options, like in the early 70s, right, if you want to put out music, if you you have to have a record label. And I think he didn't love every part of it, like the promotions and getting sent to radio stations where they were like never going to play his music, like, you know, and like the DJs or program directors would like tell him that to his face, like, oh yeah, you're great, we'll go to your show. Like, yeah, no, there's nothing on this record we're going to play. And like, this is like before the interview starts. And then like, yeah. what are we supposed to talk about? But I think he appreciated it. I think, you know, on the first record, you know, they put him together with the producer who had done like Aretha Franklin and all these really big records, but it hadn't really done anything sort of in the folk or country vein. And they sent him down to Memphis and with Elvis Presley's band. And, you know, and I think that part like was like very exciting to John because he loved Elvis. I think he sort of like, yeah, it was kind of a whirlwind, you know, and he was just sort of going along with it. I think as he sort of gotten more into the, you know, as the professional part of the business and he saw like what was going on, I think he kind of understood it a bit more. And, you know, I think probably by the time he was on, maybe by his second record on Elektra Asylum, I think he was starting to get increasingly frustrated with it.
I was wondering if he felt creatively stifled, because you hear these stories about certain situations in which labels say, hey, I want another album like that last album. It has to be the same.
Yeah.
And
the good thing for him is like he didn't have any hits on any of them, right? Like there were songs that other people covered, and, you know, back then, like all the major labels would also have a cut of your publishing, you know? So I think they were happy enough because, you know, like John Denver and Bette Midler and Carole King and a few other like people like pretty quickly covered some of the songs on the first two records. So I think they knew that, you know, look, this guy's a good songwriter. We don't know how to promote him. We don't know what to do with him. We're not going to spend too much money on him, but like, you know, I think they saw some value in having him around. But yeah, I think eventually it kind of got to be, you know, you sign to a label and the people there are excited, but eventually those people all leave and go to something else and you're still there and no one, you know, and commercially it's not doing great, but it's not bad. You know, it's getting like good press and there is an audience for it, but it's maybe not large enough to warrant your whole kind of marketing and promotion machine.
So what led him to start Oh Boy then?
So once his deal was done with Elektra Asylum, you know, I think he had a few other offers, probably not honestly great offers, to put out his music from other labels. But, you know, I think he was sort of a little disillusioned with it. He saw like, you know, I can make money if I go out on the road and play shows and I have fans, you know, I know that will support me. I don't think that he knew had that plan, like as he was making his lot, you know, I don't think he had like the next steps lined out, but he was, you know, I think it was really, I want to say that it was like the Rounder folks and like Sugar Hill and some of seeing what some of those independent labels were doing. And like, you know, I think there was like some interest there. But there wasn't really any artist owned labels at this point, you know. I think like punk music was starting to become a kind of a thing. And there was one label like it called Discord in DC that had started. But this was before, like, you know, in the 80s, it definitely became a bigger thing where you'd have like kind of like punk artists, hip hop artists, some kind of indie rock artists starting their own labels. And there was like kind of more of an explosion, especially when CDs came on too. But this was really kind of like, it wasn't a model to follow. So it wasn't like, oh, I'll just start my own label and put out music, you know, simple. Like, you know, there wasn't, it was kind of making it up as it went along. So I think a lot of folks thought it was sort of career suicide, you know, just to start, what does that even mean? You're starting a record label. What are you going to do? How are you going to make stuff, you know? How are you going to get stuff in stores? And it was, I mean, the label started in 81, but the first album didn't come out till 83. So I think it took a minute. The very first thing that came out on the record label, however, there was a 7-inch of I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus and Silver Bells. John loved Christmas. So the first thing Oh Boy ever put out was a Christmas 7-inch. And, you know, it was mail order. And I think the first store that we had stuff in was Ernest Hub Record Stores here in Nashville. And, you know, he would bring stuff on the road and he would have fans send in and give him money. And when he announced he was working on a new record, it was sort of Kickstarter before the internet existed. You know, he told people that he was going to make a new album. And if they sent him, I think it was $10. That they would mail a copy out when it was done. And they had the album funded before he went in the studio. You know, and I think we've kept some of those checks and notes just to have, just because, you know, how cool is that? That people sort of would send in, you know, to something that was, had no idea that they would get it back or if it would be good or if they would like it, but they just wanted to support John. So, you know.
When he started the label, was his intention to sign other artists or just put out his own music?
Yeah, just to put out his own music. Like there wasn't sort of like, we're going to take over the music industry. It was just sort of like, well, I think I want to keep making music, but I don't want to be on another label. I just want to do it myself because I know I have fans and I can bring it on the road and we can mail it to them. There wasn't like a design to like, you know, or thought that it was going to be like a runaway success. It was just sort of like, you know, we'll just keep it small and DIY and do it ourselves. And then I think as things started to like, you know, it was ups and downs, but I think through the 80s, they were able to keep it going. And then into the early 90s and when CDs and the Missing Years album was really, I think, a big turnaround financially for the record because it did. It was probably the first album that did like very commercially well from the beginning. And that kind of made it so the label wasn't quite as touch and go, you know, from month to month. And I think that's when the idea of like, well, we could have other artists on the label, you know, we could support, you know, and there's more staff to support John's career. So I think, you know, you're like, well, we could maybe do one or two other things. And, I want to say that the first act that was signed was a band, a rock band called the Biscuits. It's Nashville based, and there's all the guys have gone on to do like lots of other great things, but the Biscuits never, you know, like Mike Grimes, who helped start Grimey's Records here in Nashville and is like owns the Basement East, and like Tommy Womack, who's a great musician, and people who will go on to do like all lots of other great music. But that was one of the first things. We're actually going to really show that on vinyl just for kicks, I think in the next year or two. And then, yeah, I think there was some kind of feeling out, you know, it was still, even though there was a lot more labels in the 90s, like being kind of on an independent label wasn't kind of as cool as it is now. It was still seen as maybe like a stepping stone to go on, do something bigger or better, you know, whereas now I think one thinks you can have a great career and be on an independent label, you know, your whole career, you know, and still live a comfortable life. That wasn't necessarily the case back then. So I think there was still kind of some figuring out of, you know, how can we help? What can we do? Who makes sense? But, you know, there was folks that we had a pretty long-term relationship with. Todd Snyder, I think signed him in the early 2000s and put out maybe four or five of his records. And Todd's great. We still, you know, he kind of puts out his own music now. We still have a good relationship with them. And there's this guy, Dan Reeder, who John signed, I think, in 2004 or 5. Might have that wrong, but he's still on Oh Boy. And he kind of just does his thing that's different from anybody else in the world. And I think John always kind of got a kick out of being able to just sign great songwriters, and that was it. Like, he didn't have to, there was no alter, oh, it's going to be massive. It's like, no, this is just good songwriter, good music. This is different from what everyone else is doing. You know, Oh Boy's a home for that.
I was wondering what the criteria was for selecting the artists that he selected.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think it was like a little different, you know, and then being able to perform it, you know, so write your own songs and being able to perform it and go out on the road and connect with folks. I mean, we're still trying to figure out what the criteria it is. You know, it is sort of one of those things you hear it, you know, or you see it live and hear it and you're like, oh yeah, okay, that would make sense. And I think that it's probably good. I think if you ever got to like had rules, like, you know, or it would probably be too limiting. I think we always want to be like, oh, you know, you want to keep your heart open to getting just blown away by something, you know, some new thing you'd never imagined of.
How many John Prine albums were actually released on the label?
Let's see. So, you know, there was also Duet Records, like In Spite of Ourselves and For Better or Worse. He did a record with Mac Wiseman, who's a legend, Country Music Hall of Famer of duets, and, you know, three live albums and reissues. But like studio albums, there was German Afternoons, Aimless Love, The Missing Years, Lost Dogs, and sorry, I'm counting as I go, Lost Dogs and Blessings, Fair and Square. And then so like six or seven studio albums, but probably six or seven more kind of duet records and you know, live records and other ones.
Do you have a favorite?
I mean, you know, just because I was there for the making of Tree of Forgiveness, it's like, it's definitely really like kind of personal. And but, you know, the first live record I think Oh Boy put out in 1988 is really great because, you know, he's telling stories and it is sort of like the experience of going to a John Prine show, which is really hard to capture on like a studio album, you know. But that's great because that's mainly him and his guitar. And it was originally just going to be for like a German only release, but he did in 2000 a record called Souvenirs, which was like a kind of an acoustic re-recording of his earlier stuff. You know, it was cool to hear him revisiting those songs as, gosh, he would have been, I guess, in his mid to late 50s when he did that. Songs that he wrote as like, you know, in a teenager, early 20s, you know, so like obviously like Hello in There, Angel from Montgomery sounds different sung that way. And it was like, you know, it was more in the style, if you had seen him play, say from like the 90s on, that's what that record sounded like. So, you know, I think for like new material, I would say Tree of Forgiveness, but the Souvenirs record is great because it is, you know, it's an artist who has lived with these songs for decades now and like gotten to think about how he'd want to do the arrangements. And they're pretty stripped back, but he did always say on that first record, he was just so nervous. And I don't think anyone else can hear it because that record is like, you know, critically adored. But I think sometimes when he listened to it, he sort of winced a little bit because he knew he was, you know, how nervous he was and how he's like, oh, mm-hmm. I don't deserve to be here. And like in the studio with these players. So I think I always liked that record because it was someone that can almost like reckon with, you know, his achievement. You know, it's weird mm-hmm. to think, I'm sure, writing songs that like people want to cover and perform. And you didn't have any hits, but people still regard them like decades later. So, you know, like that's a real thing. And I think like John was, you know, really humble, but I think like he was also not, you know, he wasn't blind to the fact that, yeah, these were good songs, you know, and these meant something. So, I do have a special place in my heart for that one too.
It was nice that he was able to see that he was a national treasure in his lifetime.
Yeah.
Rather than having it be after, you know, one passed away. Because I think he had risen to that level long before he died. And that had to have been really nice for him to see that he was that beloved by everybody.
You know, it was. And honestly, in the last, you know, couple of years, you know, that's something that gives, I think, us a little bit of solace too, just that like he knew, like after he passed, it was an incredible outpouring of love and support and admiration and appreciation. But he did get to know how loved he was when he was alive. And, you know, that, I mean, it's still sad, but it's also like, you know, I can smile about that too, because like he got to have some like really special times and know, and other artists that he admired and you know, got to play in places that he really liked, and you know, it had meaning to him. I agree, like it's great, and certainly got me thinking more about like our community too, like, you know, are we celebrating all the artists in our community that, you know, have helped build it, you know.
Who are some of the artists that you signed more recently?
The Prine family kind of took over the label in 2015. Mm-hmm. We were pretty heavily just focused on John those first few years. But John definitely had a hand in as we brought on new talent. So Kelsey Walden was the first artist we signed. And he'd loved her voice for a long time. And she had gone and played with him before and opened a bunch of shows. And so we signed her and put her record out in, I guess, 2019, White Noise, White Lines. And that, you know, that was great. And we're actually gearing up for another Kelsey record this summer. We're very excited about. Then after Kelsey, there was a folk singer from Sacramento, Trey Burt, who signed. You know, it was great. John did get to see Trey. It was actually one of the last shows that we all went to, was one of Trey's performance in Nashville. And he was really excited about Trey's record and the one that that we put out and the new stuff he had been working on. And Arlo McKinley, who is Cincinnati-based singer-songwriter. Again, someone we'd known about and kind of liked and respected for a while. And he sort of had, you know, mutual friends of ours from his managers work with Tyler Childers, who we also love. And so when we were able to kind of work that out, and we set him up with Matt Rossbang, who's a producer based in Memphis, who we love, and who's worked with John on a few things. So that was great. And John did get to hear the record, some of the record and the songs that were going on there too. So that was great. And then the last artist we just signed was Emily Scott Robinson, who is more of kind of a, I think, more traditional, probably folk singer-songwriter, like in the vein of maybe Nancy Griffith or Patty Griffin. We just put out her record, American Siren, last year. But I think they're all different, but I do think in some ways they've all kind of, John has been there as an influence on their craft. You know, that's not a prerequisite, you know, for being on Oh Boy, but I think it's great that everyone sort of has their own story of how they came to John's music, you know, prior to being on Oh Boy.
Okay, well, what's next for Oh Boy? You're in charge now, so what is next for Oh Boy?
We've got great records from Kelsey and Arlo coming out mm-hmm. this year that we're really excited about. In the fall, we are finally going to be able to do a tribute show. Well, it's going to be really more like a week of shows for John. We had originally scheduled it for last year and had to reschedule because of Omicron and everything. And I think we finally feel good that we can have these shows now. So we're kind of calling the week You Got Gold. We have two nights at the Ryman. We have Country Music Hall of Fame. We have a show at the Basement East. There's a couple of venues we haven't announced yet, but it's all kind of going to fall in the week around his birthday in October. So we've been putting a lot of, you know, planning and thought into that. There's going to be lots of great artists, and we're looking forward to that. It's crazy that it's taken so long to do, but, you know, we thought, you know, well, October 2021 is so far away. Like, there's no way that the pandemic will still be around. And then, you know, it's crazy that it's going to have been over 2 years. I mean, it's wild. I'm sure like everyone else, like my sense of time with the pandemic is just completely out the window. But, you know, really looking forward to that. There's some other kind of cool projects we're working on that, you know, will probably come out next year around with John and sort of his legacy and some, you know, reissues of music, but then also some kind of, you know, movie and documentary projects. And then, you know, hopefully new music from artists on our label and maybe a few other things.
Well, definitely keep in touch with us. We're big fans of Oh Boy. We're big fans of John Prine and the other artists that you have on your label.
Yeah, we appreciate your support. Yeah, definitely. We you know, one of the things we are focused on too, just because of the pandemic, is like doing more things out in the world. You know, like before, it seems like everything kind of happens online or at shows, but we have trying to do more community events too. We with a good friend of mine who owns some record stores, we've been doing this thing called the Oh Boy Vinyl Brew Tour, where we go to like breweries and coffee shops, like just around the country, and set up kind of places where people can come and get music from Oh Boy artists, but also other artists, and just kind of as a communal kind of space for, you know, music lovers to hang out. That's been great. And we are looking at that too, just more ways to interact with our community. You know, I think because so much of what we do is like dependent on, you know, our community being strong. Like, so, you know, we don't think we're sort of in competition with other folks. Like we want, you know, we want like other labels like that and other musicians that are on our label to do well too, because we're all sort of trying to do the same thing. You know, it's not like we're trying to all be pop stars or get as famous. It's more like, no, we want, you know, we want our community to be really healthy and to be vibrant and strong. And then we'll all, I think, benefit. So that's one of the things that we've been really trying to hammer on this year and hopefully take into next year.
Well, everything you say sounds like the spirit of John Prine is still there. So, Jody, it's been such a pleasure talking with you about Oh Boy. You know, we look forward to hearing more from your artists, and we wish you the best this year. Maybe we'll see you in October.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Well, you guys should come down for Americana Fest too.
Of course.
Yeah, in Nashville. Yeah, we're a big part of that too.
And come see us in Memphis. Support.
Yeah, we'll be down. We love Memphis. Yeah, we'll be down. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Jody. Take care. Have a great week.
You too.
Thanks so much to Oh Boy Records' own Jody Whelan for stopping by today to chat. Be sure to visit ohboy.com to check out all the incredible music and merch they offer, as well as their social media pages, where you can give them a follow or a like and get plugged into the incredible musical community that they've created, and which we're so glad to support here at Diddy TV. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again soon, right here on Insights.